This is a Federal News Network podcast.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars sponsored by WEPA. Join NITP for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to the May 4th, 2020 For Your Benefit radio show. Today we have Dr. Ray Kirk, a federal benefits specialist now that he's retired from OPM, and he was a career federal employee. And he knows all things benefit-wise. So good morning, Ray.
Good morning, Bob. I hope you're well, and I hope everyone listening is well and dealing with our unique situation as best as possible.
Well put. And I echo that as well. So does Andrew, the ever-efficient engineer. Andrew says yes. So we're going to talk about discuss both the short- and long-term impacts of the pandemic on retirement planning and benefits. And if anybody knows retirement benefits and planning, it's Ray. So coming out of the box, what's your global comment on how this pandemic is affecting people?
Well, it's certainly making people rethink a lot of issues that, and it's caused the government to make some adjustments to the benefits programs to accommodate the various direct impacts like FEHB, TSP. So I thought today we'd just walk through some of those changes and specific changes in the plans. We'd start with kind of the near-term issues, so what applies to you today, and then move on to essentially a philosophical discussion, if you will, about some of the long-term impacts. That how's the world going to be like from the benefits and retirement point of view when the immediate crisis of the pandemic is over?
Okay, so what do we look at first? You were kind enough to give me some bullet points, so I'll do the first bullet point. So retiring while working from home or shortly after returning to the office. So if somebody's looking at retirement, do you feel, or have you seen maybe in situations like this in the past, although I think this situation is fairly unique, did you find that there was a greater retirement after, or was a lesser retirement after the issue was resolved?
I think there's a couple of perspectives on it. One, there's the people who had specific retirement plans. They were going to retire in beginning at maybe they're going to retire at the end of this month, right, the beginning of summer, or they were going to retire during one of these periods when we're people are working from home. And while OPM, the retirement operations people, are still busy at work processing retirement cases, and HR offices are still functioning in a telework mode, the reality is the federal retirement system is all a paper-based system, which means pieces of paper have to move between the HR office and some of the documents in your files have to be printed out. Then that information has to get sent to the individual. Excuse me. The actual retirement application has to be printed and requires a wet signature, which means the ink from the pen has to actually flow onto the piece of paper and then return that to the HR office. So that becomes more challenging to actually move that paper around. So I think that people who are actually planning to retire, they probably are forced to delay that, the actual retirement act, until they are back at the office and things are back some degree of normal. Those people that managed to retire and get their application in before we started working at home, they're probably going to benefit, because I would assume, we'll have to see the statistics that OPM publishes, is taking the opportunity to catch up on some of the backlog. Because they've got, again, the same number of people working, their production is probably pretty much unaffected by the retirement. And so the cases they have in their possession, they're going to have a chance to work on them with have few new cases coming in. The bottom line is, if you did retire, you got that paperwork in, probably you're going to have a positive experience in terms of OPM processing your case. If you didn't get the paperwork in, there's going to be a big pent-up demand, and it might actually slow down the processing once OPM does get that sudden rush. You know, OPM every January gets a big rush of cases that I suspect whenever things get back to, again, some degree of normality during the summer, that OPM is going to get a big rush of cases at that point, and then they're going to be faced with a backlog.
Okay, and that backlog created end of the year or the beginning of the year is oftentimes driven by the best day in the year to retire. We won't go there, but right now. But as a percentage, is it like 35% in 1 month, the end of December, early January?
Well, OPM gets it based on end of year retirements. OPM gets twice as many applications arrive at OPM in January and February. So those are people who actually their last day of work was the end of the calendar year. So they have twice as many applications suddenly in that year, in that month, than they do in other months. So I've never done the actual percentages, but it's probably, you know, in 1 month period, they probably get 20% of the year workload. And then they work their way through. They catch up about this time of year, and then they're pretty much in a steady state until the cycle starts over again.
When you address the retirement seminars, you talk about many things, but there's a discussion, the best days in the year to retire, and everybody's kind of got a different way to look at it, but it seems the popular one is the end of the year or first part of January. Do you find that people are unaware of that when they are in the class and you're teaching the class, and they probably heard about that, you know, this was an attractive date, but do they look at other dates?
A lot of people are very aware of it because the big driver about why the last day, the end of the year before the end of the leave year, is that people want to maximize the amount of annual leave they get paid for. So the way the rules operate is that when a person separates, whatever their annual leave balance is, their agency pays them off in cash. And since the leave is restricted, that there's a maximum amount of annual leave someone can carry over from one leave year to the next, which is close to the end of the year. Of course, this is the government, so it's like not exactly in sync, but it's roughly the last week of the end of December, the first week in January. That if people retire before that, they might be able to have whatever the leave balance is, which might be greater than the maximum you can carry over to the next year. So, for example, 240 hours is the maximum that most people can carry over. And what a lot of people do is that the year before they're planning to retire, they're very stingy taking annual leave, and they get to the end of the leave year, they might have as much as 400 hours of annual leave. So if they retire before the end of the year, they get paid for a lump sum of 400 hours, 8 weeks of work. Nice bonus. If they retire after the end of the leave year and they've had to use or lose leave and they can only carry over 240, they get still a nice bonus, but it's smaller. So that, boy, the end of the year is very popular, and kind of a lot of people might not understand the details of it, but it's kind of one of the folk ways of the end of the year is a good time to retire, so you should think about that.
Ray, am I thinking right that if somebody retired at or around that date and the accumulated leave was paid sometime in January, would it be coordinated with the COLA so that there would be an increase in the value of the accumulated leave equal to the COLA for the compensation? Am I thinking right there?
They do get paid at the rates, essentially the daily rates, so the government does it hour by hour. So if there was a COLA, you would get a COLA on that portion of the payment that represented time after the COLA took effect. Again, the COLA comes effective on the first day of the first pay period in January, which is again, usually somewhere at the beginning of the second week in January, just because there's 26 pay periods, but 365 days in a year, so that's not in sync, perfect sync every year.
Okay. But it's an economic reward as well. It's not huge, but every bit helps.
Right.
All righty. So we talked about focused in on the retirement date, et cetera, but we got some other bullet points here. One says, retiring while working from home or shortly after retiring to the office. So if there was a day to be picked, so if you're going to retire, this says, okay, if I retire while I'm working from home or shortly after returning to the office. So that would be a short-term impact on the date that I pick to retire?
Well, the date that you pick, there's always the general rules, which are that the effective day of an annuity, so that's the first day you're on the OPM payroll, is always refers employees the first day of the month after the month when you retire. And generally, that's true for CSRS employees. There's a slight variation in the rule for CSRS employees. So even if you decide to retire as soon as you say, I just had it, I'm going to retire as soon as I get back to work, I'm going to put my paperwork in, you still want to be focused on retiring at the end of the calendar month. So if you don't do that, you're going to have a gap between when your agency stops paying you because you're retired and when you're on the OPM payroll. So that rule is still going to apply. There's going to be probably a backlog. The backlog is going to be once the cases get to OPM, but I suspect in some agencies, particularly those agencies that have big shared service centers, like the DOD agencies, you know, they have a single service center that does retirement processing at the agency level, like at the Army, for every single department of the Army and civilian employee, the Air Force, Navy, a similar postal service. Well, they're going to be flooded with paperwork, too. So there's just going to be, I think, a backlog in actually processing the paper. You know, eventually, people are going to get paid and everything's going to catch up. But where the processing time from the day you retire to when you're in full retirement pay status might average a couple months or 2 to 3 months, I could see where it's easily going to be a month or two longer than that. So that would be something that someone would have to be aware of in their retirement and their planning to make sure they have the funds to carry them over through that period when they're not getting their full retirement benefits. They're going to get part of their benefits, but they're not going to be getting the full benefits for some length of time.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here, but when we come back, I'd like to ask you, in the classes, you know, the boots on the ground, what did you find sometimes that somebody wasn't aware of at maybe the date to retire or retirement in general? But let's talk about that when we come back, and we'll listen to what NITP can do for the listeners. WAIPA, excuse me.
You have life insurance to protect the people you love. As a civilian federal employee, you have two choices designed specifically for you, WAIPA and Fegley. The big difference? Price. Chances are WAIPA premiums will cost you less. In fact, the average WAIPA member saves $375 per year on premiums. Prioritize your peace of mind with a life insurance policy designed for feds by feds. If you're a civilian federal employee interested in comparing WAIPA to Fegley, visit waepa.org today. WAIPA is a proud sponsor of 4-Year Benefit, presented by NITP, Mondays 10:05 to 11 a.m. on Federal News Network, 1500 AM. WAIPA has been insuring the future of federal workers for more than 75 years. See why over 46,000 feds have already switched to WAIPA at waepa.org.
Welcome back to For Your Benefit. We're here talking with Dr. Ray Kirk. He's a federal benefits specialist with NITP, but more so, he's a long career, too. How long, Ray?
I was a federal employee for 41 years.
Wow.
34 of those at the Office of Personnel Management.
Okay, so Ray knows what he's talking about. So prior to the break, we talked about looking at the dates to retire and whatnot, and you talked to the classes, and I don't know if we covered this before the break, but if you were to think about the questions that you got from the class, and with all due respects to the folks in the class, this is no slight, what did you find surprising in the questions that they weren't aware of with regards to benefits?
Right. I think one of on the topic we were just talking about in terms of retirement processing, a lot of people are pretty surprised to discover that how paper-based the retirement process is. that I use the analogy that it may be 2020 at their particular agency, but it's still 1970 at OPM. That OPM processes the retirement applications pretty much the same way they did 50 years ago. Pieces of paper move around the country from the agency HR office to the agency's payroll office, and then that paper gets sent to OPM's Retirement Operations Center, where folders are put together, and somebody goes through the paper application line by line of entering the information into the computer system to do the actual calculation. So if you think about it, it's kind of the bizarre scenario. While you're an employee, your payroll records are all kept online in the payroll system. When you retire, those records get printed out on a piece of paper. That piece of paper makes a trip around the country, winds up at OPM, and OPM keys the data back into the system to calculate your benefit. So people tend to think that's a little bizarre, but it's the way OPM does business. Oh. The other thing that people... Oh, go ahead, Bob.
No, go. I'm sorry. I hiccuped.
Okay. The other thing people are somewhat surprised on, how sick leave gets used in your retirement calculation. And we talked before the break about annual leave and how that drives the fact that you get paid in a lump sum, and that drives, in many cases, the decision about when you're actually going to retire. That sick leave is treated differently. Sick leave balances get added to essentially extra credit in the retirement calculation. That whatever your sick leave balance is on the day you retire gets added to the length of service that you have that gets used in the calculation. So it's kind of a bonus payment for not taking sick leave. So as often people are unaware of just how that plays into the calculation. They think if you don't use the sick leave, you just lose it, or you get some fractional amount of it. That's often a new piece of news for people.
Do you find that many people, again, in the class were unaware of that? And you're talking to classes that are pretty close to retirement, their retirement date. Is it somewhat unknown that you can accumulate that?
I don't know. People understand the kind of the broad concept, but they aren't aware of specifically how it gets applied to your retirement. They think that, you know, there's some value of sick leave, but they get confused on how sick leave and annual leave and the different way that they are treated when you retire.
Okay. And as we're talking, I'm envisioning somebody listening to this, or you teaching a class, and even sometimes when I get to talk about taxes on the second or third day of the seminar, the changes in the TSP, there's something called a required minimum distribution. Now, this is not necessarily for everybody. It's for those 70 and a half or older, and you're required to take a certain amount out of the TSP. There's a change. It's not huge, but every bit helps for the years 2020 and 2021 that would allow the required minimum distribution to be pushed back, and you wouldn't necessarily have to take it in the year that you thought you could push it back. Now, that is going to create maybe more income, but more income in a year where most likely there's going to be less income. If it was the first year of retirement, if somebody retired other than calendar year end, or somebody that retired with a lot of accumulated leave, if they stayed on a little bit, then the tax hit might be a little bit less. I think taxes should always take a distant backseat to economics. The more you can benefit from the day you retire financially, even if you have to pay taxes on it, than to look at it and say, I'll do without a benefit just to retire later to get some kind of perceived tax benefit. So it's always good to do planning, and I suggest they go to their retirement seminar at whatever agency they're in. And again, you with much more boots on the ground here, do you find people really aren't aware of maybe this change in the law with required minimum distributions? Now, it's only going to be for 2020 and 2021, but sometimes changes in the tax law aren't the first things people want to read about.
Well, I would guess that the number of seminars that we've done at NITP has greatly been reduced during this period, so since the change has been made. I've done a few webinars, and the agency seems to be shifting to doing the retirement training via webinars because they're not having any live presentations anymore. So I really don't have a sense of how aware people are of this change. I would suspect that they're pretty unaware because again, active employees are not affected by the RMD requirements. And so it's really not until they get they're retired and they're approaching 70 years old that it becomes really on their radar screen. But I think people who are retired, who are receiving, that are taking RMDs, that I know CSP has provided some information on that, but the Thrift Board has provided information on that. I don't know exactly how aware they would be. I would suspect that a large number of people are not aware of it. Now, the one thing that's going to happen automatically is if they're taking withdrawals from TSP, so they have scheduled monthly payments from TSP, that at the end of the tax year, the Thrift Board's not going to characterize them as RMDs this year. They will be just regular withdrawals. So someone might want to, depending on their overall financial situation, if they were only taking the money out of TSP because they were required to, they might want to rethink that. So that's, I'm not sure exactly what venue. That might be a topic for a radio show about rethinking about whether you should, if you're already taking an RMD, whether you should stop taking the withdrawal or whether you should have think of an alternative way of coming up with that income that's not subject to the different tax consequences. That goes back to your point about that don't put the tax planning first, but don't ignore the tax planning.
Right. And I remember this is a long time ago in tax course in school, and the instructor had a really good sense of humor for an accountant. I'm an accountant, by the way. So he got up and he says, a deferred tax is the best type of tax. So what we're talking about here is deferring the receipt of the income until some future date. But money coming out of the TSP, there's nothing, I'm not trying to say anything bad about the TSP whatsoever, but from a tax position, the most that they withhold is 20% federal. Now, somebody in, let's say, a long-term career CSRS individual probably has a higher annuity than what somebody in FERS would, and then the money coming out of the TSP would be taxed on top of that. So the tax hit is, I'm not going to say it's horribly heavy. It's a good thing, but what's not so good about it is the most that will be withheld by the TSP is 20% federal tax and nothing, as in nothing, for state taxes. And again, this is no slight on the TSP whatsoever. This is just for somebody that didn't know that. They would have to make it up some other way through paying estimated taxes or maybe having more withheld from the annuity. But that's a whole show in and of itself. So I just want to make the comment rather than lecture.
Right. And just to add to that, from my personal experience, I can say that the first year, that was kind of a big tax surprise with the having taken the RMD. And so I have adjusted that you can ask TSP to take additional taxes out beyond the 20% that you specify X number of dollars in addition, which I've done because I got, as you said, surprised at tax time by how big the impact of that was.
Sure. Then again, not to talk too much about taxes, but if you look at a tax return, especially with somebody in FERS, it could potentially be a triple-decker sandwich, so to speak. We're going to take the annuity most likely, so that's one source. Question is, do you take Social Security now or do you take it later if you're eligible for that? And TSP. Now, eventually, all these things start to come online. Maybe not the Social Security for the CSRS folks, but most of the folks listening or retiring now are FERS. So you kind of have an issue at 70 and a half, which is a nice issue. You have different sources of income that fortunately come into play. And again, I don't want to take any limelight away from Ray and talk about taxes. So let's talk about dependent care FSAs. Something that I'm sure you know a lot about, I don't.
Okay, now a flexible spending account. That the basic idea of a flexible spending account. There are two kinds: health care and dependent care. They both follow the same basic structure. The idea is money comes out of your income while you're an employee. You have to be an employee to use an FSA. The money comes out of your income on a pre-tax basis, and then you get to use it for allowable expenses. It's health care one that's allowable health care related expenses. A dependent care FSA, you can use it for things like child care, sending your kids to camp so you can get their summer camp so you can go to work, those kinds of things. Well, the working at home and the closing of schools and the closing of child care centers has made a difference in what people's dependent expenses are. And you make elections during the open season in the fall about how much you're going to put in the dependent care FSA. Now people are learning they're not going to spend all that money because their child care arrangements are closed. That maybe you have school-aged children, they want after-school care. Well, that doesn't exist anymore. Well, there are provisions if you have it's known as a qualifying life event, that you can make mid-year changes to the amount you're having taken out of your pay for the FSA. And one qualifying life event is if your employment status changes or the change in the cost of coverage for your dependent care. So, for example, if the provider is no longer providing that care, maybe it's after school care and schools close, so they're not providing that, but that is a qualifying life event, and so you can change the amount being taken out of your FSA, taken out of your pay to fund the FSA. So someone would have to file the paperwork, because this is a bureaucracy after all, and cite that qualifying life event, but it would be an allowable way to make a mid-year adjustment to reflect the realities of a mid-year change in your cost.
All righty, we got two email questions. Let's do this. I think this one we're going to talk about now probably should go first. It says, how is Social Security going to be impacted by the pandemic? Should I increase my contribution amount to the TSP to offset any potential future cuts to my Social Security benefits? More an economic question than anything else, isn't it?
Right. It's a question about what's the future of Social Security. I don't think that COVID-19, the pandemic, is going to have a direct impact on the future of Social Security. I mean, Social Security has its long-term financing issues that's in the news very regularly. Sometimes you read articles that say that, well, Social Security is going to be reducing benefits. And in fact, the way the law is structured, if no changes are made to Social Security, and I think the projected date is something about 15 years from now, then Social Security is going to have to change the benefits, reduce the benefits. Speaking kind of just from based on my experience, of course, I don't know what Congress is going to be doing. I think the chance of that is almost zero. Social Security benefits would be reduced if Congress does nothing when it's at a crisis, when it reaches the crisis. You think about the number of people in the country that are dependent on Social Security. All of those people are voters. That the idea that Congress is going to sit around and say, well, you're just going to get now you're going to get two-thirds of the Social Security you were getting before. I mean, it seems to me it's pretty unlikely. So I think Congress is likely to do something about the Social Security funding crisis at some point before it's needed. If we look back in history, back in 1983, when Congress made a lot of significant changes to Social Security, because federal employees are well aware of that, because that's when they decided that new federal employees should be covered by Social Security, but they made some other sweeping changes to the Social Security program. But at that point in time, the projection was that if nothing was done, Social Security would have a financial crisis about 2 years later, so in 1985, that prompted Congress to take action. Well, now that the projection is that it's 15 years from now before Social Security has a crisis, my personal guess is it'll be probably 13 years before Congress addresses the issue. It's just and particularly with everything else going on in the economy as a result of COVID-19, I think changes to Social Security are going to be way on the back burner.
Okay, why did you pick those number of years?
Which number of years is that?
12? Or did you say 12 years? Just.
Well, I think I said 15 years. Oh, 12 years in Congress, they cash it. That's because the Social Security Board of Actuaries issues annual reports, and their projection, and I don't remember the exact year, but it's somewhere in the neighborhood of about 15 years from now, Social Security Trust Fund reaches a critical level where they no longer have enough money in trust fund to pay 100% of the promised benefits. So by law, Social Security then has to reduce the amount of benefits they pay so they're in sync with the amount of money that's available in the trust fund. So just looking at Congress's behavior in the past, if the crisis is going to be in 15 years, it's going to be 12 or 13 years before it rises to the top of the attention span of Congress. In recent years in Congress, it might be the day before the crisis point before Congress does anything. They seem to be more and more into last-minute decision-making.
Thank you, Ray. I thought you'd say that. I couldn't articulate it as well as you did, though, but thanks. All righty. Andrew, why don't we take a break? I think it's a good time for a break. We'll listen to what NITP can do for the listeners and listen to the WEPA commercial, too, before you listen to this one.
Who do you trust when making your most important decisions? National Institute of Transition Planning has been the trusted source for federal retirement planning, serving new, mid-career, and pre-retirement federal employees for more than 30 years. NITP's subject matter experts bring more than 800 years of collective expertise on federal benefits, financial transition, and estate planning. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com to sign up for their free monthly newsletter and information about free webinars.
Does planning for retirement seem like a daunting task? Is retirement years away? It will arrive sooner than you think. Prepare now to stay on track. Join the thousands of federal employees and retirees who have already attended National Institute of Transition Planning's free monthly webinars to learn more about retirement and financial planning. NITP is the national leader and trusted source for federal retirement information. Visit NITPinc.com to sign up for NITP's free monthly newsletter and webinar.
Welcome back to For Your Benefit. We're here today, May 4th, 2020, and we're talking with Dr. Ray Kirk, Federal Benefit Specialist, Career Fed, Fellow Seminar Presenter, talking about things that you make understandable. Because what you're talking, you know, people say something about taxes are confusing. I find federal benefits harder than tax.
There's a lot of nuances in it that, you know, one of the things I say at seminars is that when I was working at OPM, I had a coworker that his rule was that whenever anyone asks a question about the retirement programs or benefits programs, the first word of your answer is always generally, because there are always exceptions that Congress is, the service retirement system is 100 years old. And so there's a lot of amendments to the original law, and they often are very date specific. There are little windows that on a provision applies. And so it's hard to point out to something which is absolutely always true. It might be generally true, but there's a circumstance where somebody has just the right career history that they come up under some special provision.
It's good. We have another thing in common. We use generally a lot with our answers. So.
All right. Tax code is a similar vehicle.
Oh, isn't it? All righty. So we got one last question, and this probably fits into the latter part of the show. And here we go. Many federal employees are not looking forward to going back to their offices, not for any other reason other than what the question implies. There have been discussion amongst federal employees who are close to retiring about not dealing with the public, and again, the Social Security offices, and the pandemic. Most offices are very small, and the public will be waiting outside in the heat during the era of social distancing. And the individual makes a comment, I've read that 10,000 federal employees have been infected with COVID-19. What does your guest think about this? What do you think, Gray?
Well, I think the question raises a good broad question, and that is, how are people going to deal with going back to work, and what are some of the options? Actually, the president's town hall meeting that was on TV yesterday, a teacher asked a question. It's essentially the same concept, which is his question was, should schools open? The president said that he thought certainly in the fall schools should be open, but consideration has to be given to older teachers that are 60 and older who are in the high-risk groups for COVID-19. And whether special accommodations, how to deal with them going back to work. The same is true in the federal environment, that you've got employees that are in the high-risk populations because they have pre-existing health conditions, or they're older. And again, particularly in this question, where the person is talking about public-facing organizations like Social Security, where you're sitting in a close environment with people, is how are individuals and agencies going to deal with that environment? And that might influence people's decisions about retirement. They'll say that I personally am not willing to accept a risk that might be involved in it. So I think people are going to rethink some of their long-term retirement plans, you know, not just in terms of some of the financial things, which is a whole other area, but just in their how comfortable they are at work. I mean, we're used to being at work and feeling safe and comfortable. A lot of people aren't going to feel safe and comfortable at work anymore.
Interesting you mentioned that, because here I am sitting about thinking about IRS audits. IRS audits, not the business type, but the 1040 type, are generally done in an office. And if there's anything about those offices, they're not particularly spacious. I'm not saying anything bad, but they have a lot of work to do, and so they're like little cubes, but the cubes don't go from ceiling to floor or floor to ceiling. So I'd imagine that would stop the audit process, would slow down, and probably they'll have mail audits where IRS would send, please explain this deduction you claim for X, Y, and Z. I know that was not the question that the individual asked, but I thought the same thing, that I don't think there's a lot of difference between walk-in business at either one of the two agencies, Social Security or IRS. But let's get back to the questions. I'm sorry, Ray. What were you going to say? Sorry.
Well, I was just going to give you another example, an experience I had during one of the seminars for NITP, that I was at a census Bureau office out in the Midwest, and it was really old school. Not only did you not have cubicles, but there was a room that was like about the size of a basketball court, and there were just desks lined up next to each other, no dividers at all. You know, just row and row of desks, and people working, as I say, in this basketball court size room. Must have been 300 people to work in that space. And the hallway, the corridor to get from one part of the building went through this room. I mean, they're going to have to rethink the design of their office space. They certainly aren't going to continue with it like that.
Wow. Okay, long-term impacts. We talked an awful lot about looking at, I won't say the short term, but we're looking at retirement as a period to be satisfied. But once we do retire, the long-term impacts would include, and we got three bullet points here, reduction in TSP balances on retirement planning. In other words, currently the TSP, assuming the money is outside fully in the G fund, some might be in the I fund, S fund, C fund, et cetera. So those that have all their money in the G fund, this next discussion doesn't have much of a impact. So reduction in TSP balances on retirement planning based on the market hit and interest rates. I mean, interest rates are extremely low, so the money in the I fund, if you're putting new money into it, might be a debate. Anyway, what do you think, Ray? You're an economist too, right?
Well, the long term. So this is, we talked earlier about the decision about should I retire right away. So that's, but this is broader about what am I going to do in the future? As you pointed out, the CSP fund balances have gone down substantially, and so the decision is, by waiting till those recover, you know, and how long is that going to take? This may be just the concern of long term safety, that whatever my strategy was, and how dependent I'm going to be on that TSP portion of my retirement benefit, it was really going to influence somebody's long-term thinking. Or, and long-term may mean the next year or so. I have a friend who was planning to retire at the end of this year, but now she's rethinking that for two reasons. One is that her own TSP account has gone down substantially. So her planned retirement income, she'll still, of course, get her FERS annuity. She'll get with the Social Security benefits will be unaffected. But the amount that she could be withdrawing from TSP is going to be affected. But even more significant is her husband is not a federal employee, and his entire retirement benefits are based on a 401k. Well, that plan has also substantially been reduced. So the family retirement income is taking essentially a double hit. Greatly changing her long-term plan. So her plan to retire the end of this year is now an indefinite hold. And I'm sure there are a lot of other people that we tend to get pretty focused on looking only at the federal employees, but federal employees are often part of a household that has non-federal employees. And so the economic impact on TSP also hit the 401ks and so it's 356, 357, the ones for state and local employees. So there's a lot of, and that spills over into the retirement planning of federal employees. So what you're going to, it just creates some more unknowns. I personally think a lot of people are just going to sit around and wait for another couple of years. If they're planning to retire in a year or so, they're going to say, well, maybe I'll wait for 5 years.
I'm glad you said that. There's a term that people will use, and people may have heard this comment, this will not be a V-shaped recovery. Now, what you're talking about is a stock market. So picture on a graph the heavy downturn in your stock market portfolio's value is dropping. Now, a V-shaped recovery would mean once it hit the lowest, it bounced back up with equal strength. That would be a V-shape. I don't think that's going to happen with this one because already we've got a significant period of time, but the markets probably will not jump right back. It's going to take a while. I'm not an economist, and I shouldn't be talking about – I can talk about financial planning, but I shouldn't be giving advice. I think you just need to be aware of that. And then like you talked about, Ray, you've talked to people that are maybe going to stay on another year or two only to make up for the fact that the values were hit, assuming they had money in the stock associated funds.
It's going to be a big period of unknowns, and those unknowns are going to affect every aspect of life. It's going to affect also kind of related is that someone's post-retirement lifestyle. I mean, they had a plan of what retirement was going to look like. Some of that plan was based on how much money they thought they would get out of their TSP account. But some of it was just those lifestyle issues. You have people that, in Florida, they refer to them the snowbirds, that they live in one part of the country. You live up north for part of the year, and then you go down to Florida. So people viewed retirement as the opportunity to just kind of travel around at will, to have a free and easy lifestyle, if you will. I think people are going to rethink that a great deal. I mean, in the short term, no one's going anywhere. But even when you have the flexibility to go places, I think people are going to think twice, maybe three times, about whether I should go on that long trip, whether I should wind up on a cruise ship. I mean, that's one whole thing that and lots of that's kind of the retirement dream. I'm going to go on long cruises. Well, that may not be the dream anymore. And just going on trips, people are going to go shorter distances, maybe. I don't know, but it's going to cause people to, I think, a large reassessment of what retirement looks like.
Yeah, I see things in the paper and on the TV, and I'm sure anybody listening as well as Ray do the same. And you see some people going out when maybe they shouldn't, but they go out. But I don't know if it's ever going to go back to, you know, the pictures of certain beaches, whether they're East Coast, West Coast, or the Gulf Coast. It gets pretty crowded in the summer. And I would think that this summer probably won't be as crowded. Let's hope it's not lifelong, though. So post-retirement lifestyle plans. We're not trying to look at the negative here, but, you know, the lifestyle, maybe we envision being able to do X, Y, or Z that we didn't do during our work years, and we had the cash flow to do it. So I don't think we want to paint a picture that you can't do anything other than go out to pick up the paper in the morning. So it's going to take some time to know where we're going. I don't know that anybody has the ability to prognosticate now. But in the classes, probably in the classes, we weren't doing too many classes after the market turned sour. But did you find the questions coming from the class that people really had an eye on the prize? In other words, can they afford to retire? And again, most of the classes are heavily populated, if not 100% populated by FERS folks, and maybe every 10 classes at CRS. It's a different economic profile for the CSRSers and the FERS. But I feel that a lot of them felt confident, the FERS individuals. By the time I got there, Ray always goes on the first day to talk about federal benefits. I might go on the second or third day to talk about tax, generally speaking, with the financial planner. And I saw, you know, in let's say the let's say in the last year, people were starting to talk about, gee, it's been an awful nice ride, but can it continue? And then somebody would talk about what fund to go into, and that's where I'd go, I'm a tax person, not a financial planner. And invariably, the financial planner had talked about that. So you come on board teaching on the first day. So maybe you get some, do you get any naive questions regarding the finance side of the benefits?
Well, a lot of that. They ask finance questions, things, what will be the best fund, what kind of strategies. I have the advantage of saying, well, you're going to learn about that tomorrow. And then, depending how specific the question was, often I will send an email to the instructor that's coming and say, you know, there's a specific interest about this issue. That sometimes I just make a generic hand waving and say, I'm not a financial planner. You'll learn all about that tomorrow, and you'll learn about taxes. So I push the kick the can down the road. I act like Congress in that sense. I say, well, I don't have to deal with it. But I think those questions are going to be, there'll be more of those questions.
I think so too. And
I think I'm just going to say to people. I think some people are going to be concerned, kind of like the earlier questions we had, is that is Congress going to react to this by reducing some of those benefits that we viewed as stable? Are they going to make changes in Social Security, changes in SERS and FERS? Again, I think there's little risk of that in the short term. I actually think there's little risk of that in the long term, but people will be concerned about it because it's created a period of instability, and I think not only feeling uncomfortable about going out and interacting with the rest of the world, but it's going to be financial instability and concerned about what their own future lifestyle is going to be.
Okay, good. We've tried during the show to be on the upbeat side of a downbeat subject, but let's close this out. Lessons learned from the pandemic, COVID-19, on long-term care planning. We have all of about 2 minutes, Ray, but go ahead.
Okay, well, I'm not sure that's going to be on the upside. I think that there's a lot of people rethinking the model of that older individuals that move to the assisted living facilities or nursing homes, independent living facilities where they're in a group setting and they get support services. Well, a lot of those people now, the pandemic, those environments have not been wildly successful in dealing with just some of the medical issues. And the result, in many of those places, their way of dealing with those medical issues is they put people on lockdown. People go to these senior living communities because it's the chance to interact and lead a productive and social lifestyle. That's all being eliminated. So, people probably are going to be less likely to move to those facilities in the future if there's the risk that it's not going to create the lifestyle that they're hoping to have.
Okay. One question is a bullet point here that you sent me yesterday, and says reduction in TSP balances on retirement planning, and then underneath it says Maureen example.
Well, that was the person that I talked about that was planning to retire at the end of this year, but now has revised her plans because not only was her TSP reduced, but her husband's 401k, well, a significant part of their family retirement benefits, is substantially negatively impacted by the stock market drop.
Okay, good. Now, were any other bullet points on the email you sent me? I thought I covered them all, but I didn't think I covered that.
Yeah, I think we have pretty much two things. Again, one last few seconds here, that a lot of these issues incurred. This is, we just had in April, Financial Education Month, that it becomes more and more important for people to be aware and have contingency plans in their financial planning about what happens if the world doesn't stay as it was for the last 5 years. What if we have the sudden change? How do my financial plans accommodate that?
Okay, well, Andrew says you're going to be retired if you don't get off the air. He's going to retire us. So, Ray, final comments?
Well, I just hope, kind of to re-echo what we started with, I hope everybody is doing well and that they have found a way to accommodate this new lifestyle, and are, when the world reopens again, that they have moved into a safe environment and are able to deal with it.
Way to go, Ray. We have 4 seconds to go. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week. Thanks, Ray. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP and sponsored by WEPA. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. This show can also be heard on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search For Your Benefit. Thanks for listening.